And we're holding on page Gimel in Gittin, the paragraph labeled Daf Ches Amud Aleph from Nachman Bar Yitzchak, middle of Os Hey. The Gemara talks about, so at the beginning of the Masechta Gittin talks all about the case of Hamevi Get Mimdin Asayam, a person brings a get from an overseas country and he has to be able to say Bifana Nechta, Bifana Nechta, and the Gemara spends a lot of time discussing the ins and outs of that halacha. So eventually now the Gemara brings a case. What about if a person brings a get that was written on one of the rivers in Eretz Yisrael? And the question, the Gemara gets into the discussion basically, are the rivers considered part of the land of Eretz Yisrael or not? Then eventually the Gemara says, and here's where En Yaakov picks up, Rav Nachman Yitzchok Amar, B'nahoris to Eretz Yisrael to kol amalei pligi. No, the Machloikas is not actually about the rivers in Eretz Yisrael. If somebody was on a riverboat in Eretz Yisrael and he wrote a get over there, there's no question that that's considered like Eretz Yisrael, and he doesn't have to say b'fon enecht or b'fon enecht, and because neither of the reasons that the Gemara discussed throughout these first few blocks, neither of the reasons for that takana would apply in that case. Ki pligi b'yamagod. Rav Nachman Yitzchok says the machlokas is about the parts of the Mediterranean Sea that are considered part of Eretz Yisrael. So there you have the question, given the two reasons for why you need to say b'fana nechta, b'fana nechta. One reason is because ein edim mitzuyim l'kaimai, because edim may not be available to be mitzuyim it, because people don't travel as much of that back and forth between there and Eretz Yisrael, and the other because they're not familiar with the concept of the Shema. So in the people who live on those islands in the Mediterranean may not be familiar with those dinim either. So to Tanya, we learn in a braisa. What is the definition of where is the border between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz? So first of all, here is the land border. Kol shishifei aviyoded, where it slopes downward, miturei amonon, from Turei Amonon, which is a range of mountains in the north of Eretz Yisrael. Now, in Parshas Maaseh, when it gives the borders of Eretz Yisrael, so it mentions the northwestern border as you start from the Mediterranean and start going along the northern border. The first point over there is called Hur Hur. So now, our Gemara is telling us that this is identical with a range of mountains called Turei Amonon. Those are actually a mountain range in what's nowadays southern Turkey. By the corner, you have the northeast corner of the Mediterranean. There's a range of mountains there that, up until recent times were called the mountains of Amanos or something like that, which is the Pashto's the same as Turei Amnon of Argamara over here. With that said, there are various Sfarim and various Mephoshim that argue that maybe Har 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 is not quite that far north. According to that, it would come out that pretty much all of modern Lebanon and a good chunk of today's Syria and even parts of Turkey would be part of halachic Eretz Yisrael, whereas there are other opinions that place Har 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 much further south. Anyway, our Gemara is saying from Turei Amonon, v'lifnim, anywhere further inward from that, Eretz Yisrael is part of Eretz Yisrael. So anything south of Turei Amnon, miturei Amnon v'lachutz chutz la'aretz, anything beyond Turei Amnon is considered chutz la'aretz, is outside Eretz Yisrael. And the Braisa continues, v'hanasin shabayam, what about as far as the islands in the sea? Roy and Oysan, what we consider, how do we determine which ones are part of Eretz Yisrael or not? We consider kilu chut masua haleim miture amnon ad nachom mitzrayim. We imagine as though there's a line drawn from Ture Amnon, which is the northwestern corner of Eretz Yisrael, down to Nachal Mitzrayim, which is the southwestern corner of Eretz Yisrael. Here also you have different opinions among the various Mephoshim and Rishonim and Achronim and all, where exactly Nachal Mitzrayim is. Some say that it's part of the Nile. Others say that it's a stream called nowadays Wadi El Arish, which is some distance south of Gaza. Anyway, you draw a straight line from Turei Amnon in the northwest down to Nachal Mitzrayim in the southwest, Minachut v'lefnim, Eretz Yisrael. Anything that's on the inside of that line belongs to Eretz Yisrael. So any islands that are there. And you look nowadays on a map, actually, you'll find in a few places off the coast of Eretz Yisrael, there are in fact small islands. So those islands would be considered part of halachic Eretz Yisrael. Minachut v'lachutz chutz la'aretz. Anything beyond that line is chutz la'aretz. So therefore, said Rav Nachman Yitzchok says, the machloikas that the Gemara had brought before, that's not here in Ein Yaakov, regarding whether you would need to declare b'fanei nechta, b'fanei nechta, if a get was written on one of those islands, so Rav Nachman Yitzchok saying, even though the Mishnah had presented it in terms of rivers, it's not actually rivers, the expression actually had been a get that was brought on a boat. So he explains, we don't mean a river boat, we mean a sea boat that came from one of those islands to the coast of Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yehuda gives a different opinion. kol shekineged Eretz Yisrael, harehu ke'Eretz Yisrael. Anything that's opposite Eretz Yisrael, anything that's in the same latitudes as Eretz Yisrael, harehu ke'Eretz Yisrael, then he says is considered part of Eretz Yisrael as well. Shenemar, and he says, because the pasuk says, Ugvulyam, the western border of Eretz Yisrael, v'hoya lachem ha'yam ha'gadol, the Mediterranean Sea should be your border, Ugvul, and the border, Zeyir lachem gvulyam, this should be your western border. So the Tanakhama had learned that that means that comes to include those islands that are within that line that you, that goes from Turei Amnon until Nachal Mitzrayim. So basically a line that goes within a few miles of the coast, more or less parallel to it. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda is saying that it means that we draw two parallel lines, one from the northwestern border of Eretz Yisrael, and the other from the southwestern border, and anything that's within those lines, he says that's what the pasuk means, that all of that is considered part of the border of Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, he says, V'anasin shebet tzadin, and then when it comes to the islands on the side, as you go through there, you have the island of Cyprus, you have all the number of the Greek islands, you have various islands off the coasts of Europe and of Africa. So he says, Royan oisen ki l'chut masuah haleihen. We imagine as though a line is drawn straight, Mikafluria v'ad yam okianus, from Kafluria, which was a town on the top of Turei Amnus, and on top of Turei Amnun. Rashi and Tosfos discussed. Tosfos has a long discussion over here in the printed Gemara where exactly this Kafluria is, the peak of Turei Amnon that we said before. Was it that the slopes of it slope down to the north and south or to the east and west? So anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda is mentioning a place called Kafluria, which was on top or near the top of that mountain, Vad Yamuk Yanus, all the way till the ocean. In the same way from Nachal Mitzrayim, wherever we define that, in the southwestern corner of Eretz Yisrael, you draw a straight line all the way to the ocean. Minachut v'lefnim Eretz Yisrael, anything within those two lines belongs to Eretz Yisrael. Minachut v'lachutz chutzlaret, anything beyond those lines belongs to chutzlaret. So in other words, according to Rabbi Yehuda, a fair amount of the Mediterranean Sea is part of Eretz Yisrael la'halacha. Now, the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda, but there is Tosfos actually brings an interesting point that Rabbeinu Peter, which is a pretty interesting name in itself, asked Rabbeinu Tam, in that case, according to Rabbi Yehuda, would it come out? He says, we who live in France, would we be considered that we live in halachic Eretz Yisrael? So Rabbeinu Tam answers him a couple of answers, one of them being that maybe in halacha we distinguish between the borders of Oyle Mitzrayim and Oyle Bavo. You have the borders of Eretz Yisrael when the Jewish people first, and when they came out of Mitzrayim and then 40 years later entered Eretz Yisrael and conquered a very large area. And then you have, after Golas Bavo, when they came back to build the second Mikdash, they resettled Eretz Yisrael, but a much smaller area. So there's many areas that were conquered and settled by Oyle Mitzrayim, but not by Oyle Bavo. So first of all, Rabbeinu Tam says these places that we're talking about over here, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, these parts of the Mediterranean, may not be part of the borders of Oyle Bavo, and therefore they don't have the full status of Eretz Yisrael la'halacha. So a couple of other things, Tosfos ends up pointing out that actually, even if we don't say that, we would distinguish between the continents versus the islands. In order for a place, in Rabbi Yehuda's definition, to be part of Eretz Yisrael, it would have to be an island that's completely within these lines, not, for example, parts of the continent and parts of North Africa and parts of Italy and whatever would be partially within that line and partially outside that line. No, those don't count as parts of Eretz Yisrael. And for the same reason, France, and Tosfos HaRosh points out, anyway, that besides that, if you look on a map, really, France is a good deal north of this anyway. Even the southern tip of France is much further north than any part of Eretz Yisrael, so there's no question that it wouldn't be anyway. There is an interesting thing, though. There's an island off the coast of Tunisia called Djerba. It has a Jewish community. It's had for hundreds, even thousands of years. It's said that it goes back to the time of the first Beis Hamikdash. Very unusual in that, for example, they have a kehillah there that's almost entirely koyanim. So like this you have in Shulchan Aruch, dinim about a city or a shul that's all koyanim and certain dinim that apply, so they actually have that happen over there. Anyway, they have the Kabbalah, their kehillah goes back to the time of the first Beis Hamikdash, but anyway, they also have an interesting idea that their country is actually a part of Eretz Yisrael that was broken off and then wound up there in the western Mediterranean. But based on our Gemara over here, it may be that they're saying basically, according to Rabbi Yehuda's Shita, if you look at a map, their island of Djerba, Taka, comes out within these boundaries that Rabbi Yehuda is marking over there, and therefore, in a certain sense, it can be considered part of Eretz Yisrael. An interesting question, by the way, is, what about, he's saying, only until the ocean? What about if you go beyond the ocean, and you have the Americas on the other side of it? Does that mean that the same latitudes in North or Central America would also be part of Eretz Yisrael? I don't know, it's a good question. According to Rabbi Yehuda, and the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda, but according to that, it might mean that hypothetically, according to Rabbi Yehuda, maybe parts of Georgia and South Carolina and whatever would also, to a certain extent, be considered Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so the Gemara goes on to discuss other dinim as far as dinim of writing a get. So at one point the Gemara brings a three way machlokas about a particular detail between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. So the Gemara brings that Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Shenemru Dvorim Lefnei Rabbi Yosi, when they told over Rabbi Shimon's statement on that particular din to Rabbi Yosi, Kora Olava Mikra Azeh, he applied to it the following pasuk: Sfasayim Yishak Meshiv Dvorim Nechoichim. The one who responds with correct words deserves a kiss from the lips. In other words, that we should appreciate a Talmud Chacham who comes up with a correct statement in halacha. Meaning, in other words, my Ram Schiff explains over here that since in that braisa that the Gemara had brought, you have a three-way machlokas, and you have in particular Reb Shimon replies to something that Reb Yehuda had said. So now Reb Yossi is extremely impressed by Reb Yossi's shitta, and he says that by Reb Shimon's shitta, and therefore he says on him this pasuk that people should kiss him for having said such a good thing. Tosfos gives a different expression. Sfasayim Yishak can also mean, besides being kissed, it can also mean to purse their lips. So it can also mean Reb Shimon has such a good statement that everybody else should keep their lips closed, and like they have nothing else to say against what he said, because it's clearly correct. So we see, in other words, it's expressing the idea that you should show respect for a Talmud Chacham who comes up with a great idea in Torah, and Rabbi Yossi himself. The Gemara, by the way, mentions in other places that Rabbi Yossi himself, it's called Nimukoi Imo. The Gemara says actually it's later in Ar Masechta. Rabbi Yossi, whenever he said an explanation, whenever he said a statement in Halacha, he always had a good reason to back it up. It wasn't just this is how I heard from my Rebbeim. He's always able to show a logical basis for it. So now he's saying that he heard what Reb Shimon said and he was very impressed by it. So that means a lot coming from Reb Yossi, who himself is always a master of Svara in Torah. By the way, the Gemara does mention that even though Reb Yossi praises Reb Shimon, nevertheless, the Gemara says that the halacha is nevertheless like a mayor, despite the fact that Reb Yossi praised. And we have such things sometimes where the Gemara will say that one Tana or one Amora praises another, and nevertheless, that doesn't establish the halacha that way. Further on in the perek, it talks about, now you can have a case where a person, you have a case where you send a shliach to pick up a get, and then related to that, the Gemara talks about the case where a person sends a shliach to take money or goods for him from one place to another. In particular, the Gemara eventually gets into a din, that if you send somebody to pick up something for you, a pikadin, for example, something that you deposited for safekeeping someplace else, so the question is, so ordinarily you, the shliach, would have to take responsibility for it on the way. On the way it could get lost or stolen or what have you, and you have to take responsibility, unless you arrange with the person who gave it to you that he'll make a kinyan, that he's releasing you from responsibility. So in this connection, the Gemara tells the following story. Rab Achi b'Rab Yoshia, havele ispika de kaspa ben hauda. Rab Achi b'Rab Yoshia had a silver cup that belonged to him that was in the hauda, that had been deposited with some people over there for safekeeping. Ben Yehoyada points out, by the way, that later on in the story we see that Rab Achi b'Rab Yoshia did not know these people. So it might be that his father, Rab Yoshia, deposited it with them for safekeeping, and then Rab Yoshia passed away, and now Rab Achi wants to get it from the people, but he doesn't know them personally. Anyway, Omalele Rab Destoy b'Rab Yanai or Rab Yoshi Bar Kippur. So he tells Rabbi Destoy b'Rab Yanai and Rabbi Yossi bar Kippur, Bahadi da'asisu, while you're going to Nahuda, also do me a favor, asiyuha nihali, bring me that cup as well, while you're going to Nahuda, and something else. What were they going to Nahuda for? Now it's interesting, we have a Gemara in the Bavli and Brachos, the Rishami also tells it in a couple of places, that mentions these two chachamim in a completely different context. So the Pashtus, it was all part of the same trip. What happened was, the Gemara tells us in all those places, that at that time in Bavel, and in particular in Nahuda, which was the center of Jewish life in Bavel in those days, there was Hananiah ben Achi Rabbi Yeshua, Hananiah, the nephew of the famous Rabbi Yeshua, who was determining, he had a Beis Din over there, and he was deciding when Rosh Chodesh should be and when leap years should be. Normally, only a Beis Din in Eretz Yisrael is supposed to do that. Now, Hananiah was a tremendous Talmid Chacham, so eventually, though, the Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael sent word to him with these two Chachamim to tell him that he has to stop. And he said, wait a minute, when there's nobody as great as me in Eretz Yisrael, and the halacha is, in that case, I'm allowed to do it in Chutz La'aretz. And they explained to him that, no, since you left many Eretz Yisrael many years ago. It's true, at that time, it was like there were only young kid goats over there, but now those kid goats have grown up. They say, Gdoyim Nasu Tioshim, the young goats have grown up, and now they're mature goats, and they're the ones who sent us to tell you that you have to knock it off, because now there's a based in Eretz Yisrael who's capable of doing this again, and you have to stop doing it here. In Chutz La'aretz. And the Gemara actually mentions Rabbi Achi Rabbi Yoshia in connection with that story as well, so it seems it's all part of one of the same story. They've been sent by the Chachamim, by the Beis Din in Eretz Yisrael, to tell Hananiah to stop, that now that there's Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael to do this, then he can't do it in Chutz La'aretz anymore, so they're traveling all the way from Eretz Yisrael to Na'udah, which is where Hananiah lived, and so Rabbi Achi Rabbi Yoshia is telling them that while they're going to Na'udah, please go pick up his silver cup. Ozul, so they went, Yavi ni Eliyahu, and the people who were keeping the cup gave it to them. Amri lahu, but then they said, Nikni minaihu. We want to make a kinyan from you that you will take responsibility for it on the road. Because again, without such a kinyan, then if it gets lost or stolen or whatever, then Rav Achi, the owner of the cup, is going to come back to us and demand that we should repay him for it. And we don't want that responsibility. We want to be free of responsibility once we give it to you, Shluchim, so you have to accept that responsibility with a kinyan. Amri lahu loy. So the two shluchim, Rabbi Destoy and Rabbi Yossi, said, no, we don't want to take that responsibility. Amri lahu, so the people told them, ahadri ni'alon. In that case, return the silver cup to us. We're not willing to give it to you to take to Rab Achoy unless you're willing to take that responsibility to that on the way, that if something happens to it, you're going to have responsibility for it as a shomim. So, Rav Destoy, Rav Yanai, Omolahu Ein, Rav Yossi, Rav Kippa, Omolahu Loi. So now the two shluchim couldn't agree between them what to do. Rav Destoy, Rav Yanai said, yes, fine, we'll return you the cup. Rav Yossi, Rav Kippa said, no. Now they started troubling and paining Rabbi Yossi Bar Kippur. The Yerushalmi here in the parallel Yerushalmi here on this Mishnah in Gittin tells the story as well. It says that afterwards, Rav Destoy is describing, afterwards we're going to see in Or Gemara also, he describes how terrifying an experience it was. He says, over there in the Yerushalmi, I saw the whip going up and down. They were beating Rabbi Yossi Bar Kippur with whips, Pasha. So Rabbi Yossi Bar Kippur said to Rav Destoy, Chozi Mar, Heicha Kovid. Rebbe, look what they're doing. They're beating me up they said to Rav Destoy, Chozi Mar, Hamai Kovid. Look at what this guy's doing. He doesn't want to give us back the silver cup. He's stealing from us, basically. So Rav Destoy answers them, Tav Ramulei. Give him lots of blows, meaning go ahead, beat him up as much as necessary to get him to return it. Or Rashi's second explanation is Tav Ramulei, he deserves this beating. Now, how could Rabbi Yossi do that? How could he throw Rabbi Yossi under the bus? That's the Gemara is going to explain in a minute what was happening over here. Ki also Lagabe, when they came back to Rabbi Achoy without the cup, Omalei, so Rabbi Yossi Bar Kippur says to Rabbi Achoy, Chozi Mar, look, Rebbe, Loi Mistaye, the Le Sayan, not only, it's not enough that this story didn't help me when I was being beaten up like that, El Omolahu Nami Tav Ramulei, he's telling them, beat me up well, or he deserves the beating. What's going on over here? How can you do that to me? Omolahu, so Rabbi Achoy says to this story, am I Tevin Hochi? Yeah, why'd you do that? Why'd you throw him under the bus like that? And actually, Rashi says not even that. Why did you agree right away to return the cup? Meaning, in other words, maybe you should have also told them that you're not willing to like this. You said you're willing to, so now they took it out. And Rabbi Yossi figuring he's just being unreasonable. Maybe if you had told them also, you know what, we're both united on this. Neither one of us is going to give it back unless you release us from that responsibility. Then they would have said, you know what, okay, we do, you know, fine. Then in that case, we'll do that. Now that you gave in right away, then they figured they could get away with beating Rabbi Yossi. Why'd you do that? Amalei, this story explains, I want to explain to you how scary these people are. Oisim b'nei Adam, these people that we're dealing with over here, Heim Amma, they are an Amma in size. Now, Rashi says that doesn't literally mean they're an Amma tall. It means fakert. It means like you have to measure their height in Ammas. They're very tall, imposing people. The kaiva on Amma, and their hats are also an Amma in height, so like they have these unusually tall hats or helmets or something, which makes them look extra scary, extra imposing and scary. Marshall gives a different explanation, actually. Marshall says that maybe Hain Amma means literally they're short people, they're an Amma tall, but then they wear a hat that's an Amma tall, so they look like inhuman, they look like something like some kind of weird apparition or something, so they're very scary. We find, for example, the Pare in Moshe Rabbeinu's time, as the Gemara tells us, was an Amatol. Sometimes, yeah, these short people are the meaner types, you know. Like they say they call it the Napoleon complex. So Umadabrim Nechatsyehen, and they speak from their midsection. So Rashi explains means they have very deep, booming voices. So it sounds like their voice is coming from their stomach. Marsha says, given his explanation, that it means that they were literally an Amma tall, and they wore hats and Amma tall, they're speaking with their mouths, but because of that, an Amma plus an Amma of the hat, so their mouth is approximately in the middle, so therefore it looks like they're speaking from the middle of this weird apparition over here. Ushmaseya Mabuholim, and even their names are scary. Arda v'arta upili b'resh. Rashi just quotes those names without explaining them, which apparently means that Rashi understood those to be the actual names, and he just wanted to make sure we have the correct girsa. So Arda and Arta, so what do they mean? Various Achronim talk about different possibilities that Arda, basically Arda and Arta seem to be Persian names that represent greatness and power and whatever. So like we're not talking that these are not the names that were given by their bris necessarily. These are names that they had, that they gave for themselves, or that people called them, or prefixes to their names or something that indicate how strong and powerful and mighty they are. So Arda and Arta are Persian prefixes that mean strong. Pili means elephants, like strong people as strong as elephants. Beresh could either be part of the name, Pili Beresh, the elephant that goes at the head, or Beresh could mean he's the head, he's the leader of them, or it could be Beresh means this is the beginnings of their names, begin with these kinds of things, indicating how powerful they are. Anyway, continues of this story, these are the kind of people, if they order their servants to tie people up, then they're the people are going to be tied up. And if they say kill, then they're going to kill. They have tremendous absolute power. So therefore, I was afraid of them, Poshet. Ilu hogu the destroy. So if they had killed me, destroy me, nothing. Yanai Abba Bar Kamosi. Who would ever give my father Yanai somebody of my caliber? And Elizabeth destroy knows what he is. He knows he's a great, important Talmud Chacham, and therefore, it's not saying he can't go and sacrifice his life just for this, for a silver cup. So therefore, that's what he's saying. That's why I was willing to give in to them right away. And that's why also when they were beating up Rabbi Yossi, I didn't protest because I realized that I'm going to end up getting beaten and possibly killed as well. We had something similar in Nedarim. We had a few weeks ago in Nedarim something along the same lines where Ula was accompanying two Jews on the way to Eretz Yisrael, and then one of them killed the other, and then he asks Ula, did I do good? And then Ula tells him, yes, you did well, because he was afraid that otherwise the guy may kill him as well. Let me ask you, are these people actually close to the government? You're saying they have the ability, they have their servants and everything. Does that really mean, are they really close to the government and therefore they have such absolute power? He says, yes. So he asked him, Yeshlem Susim Prodim Shirotzim Achareim, do they have a whole entourage of horses and mules that run behind them, also indicating that they're very powerful? Amalei Hain, and Rabbi Yisroel says, yes. Amalei Sirabacho, he says, Yehochi Shaper Abdus. In that case, you did correctly, then in that case, yes, you're right. You shouldn't risk your life dealing with such people and then going against them where they might beat or kill or whatever, as you were saying, because yes, it's true. If they're that close to the government and they have that much wealth and power and everything, then yes, they might have ended up killing you, and you're right. You're right. You shouldn't have to be Moser Nefesh for such a thing. There is an interesting discussion among Rishonim and Achronim Bechlal over the question. There's a concept in Halacha, you're not allowed to be Matzil Atzmei B'Momen, or the question is, are you allowed to be Matzil Atzmei B'Momen Chaveroi? Are you allowed to save your own life by using somebody else's Momen? There's relevant Gemaras on it, besides for here, there's one at the end of Bava Basra, there's a story And it's got Baba Kama. There's one in the middle of Baba Kama, also involving David, and a war against the Plishtim. So there's a number of Gemaras that bear on this point. And there's a Machlokas Rishonim on the question. Okay, everybody agrees that if you're Matzalatzim and Mamon Chaveri, you're chayav to pay. But are you allowed to do it in the first place, and just afterwards you have to pay, or are you not allowed to do it in the first place, based on those various Gemaras? So here we have an example. Basically, he's being Matzalatzim and Mamon Chaveri. He's saving himself at the cost of Rav Acher Bar Yoshi, his silver cup. So was he allowed to do that, or is it after the fact? Rabbi Choy tells him, you know what, you did right. Another point that's made in this connection, when he's saying, who would give my father Yanai, a son like me, that's also a valid consideration. If he really is somebody very great and irreplaceable, then yeah, that might be a valid reason for him to say that he might be entitled to be Matzalatzim and Mamon Chaveri, and just afterwards he'll have to pay. Okay. Hamedi Perek Sheni. So the second perek of the Masechta begins by continuing to talk about these dinim of b'fanei nechta, b'fanei nechtam. So eventually, it gets into a machloikas like this. Now, if you have one person comes bearing a get from Chutzlaret, then he has to be able to say b'fanei nechta, b'fanei nechtam. The question is, what about if he, and then the point is, then the Gemara establishes, then what it is effectively, he presents that get in front of a beis din, and the three of them together, and all of them together, in effect, he presents it rather in front of two edim, and the three of them, in effect, become a beis din, and then you can give the get in their presence. What about the Gemara discusses? What if you have two people bringing the get? Do they need to be able to say b'fanei nechta, b'fanei nechtam? The question basically boils down to two of them alone can be edim, so they could actually testify about the validity of the get. So do they need to be able to declare b'fanei nechta, b'fanei nechtam, or is it enough that they testify this get is being given by Pliny to his wife Plinius? So the Gemara mentions the machlokas on that topic. So the Gemara says, Rabba Baba Chana Cholosh. Rabba Baba Chana one time was not feeling well. Ula Gabe Rabbi Yehuda, Rabba L'Shayuli Bey. So Rabbi Yehuda and Rabba, or different gear says, Rabbanon, the other Chachamim, came to visit him to be Mevaka Chola. Now, when they're doing Vika Cholim to a great Talmud Chacham like Rabba Baba Chana, they're not just going to stand sitting talking about the news or whatever, they're going to talk in Torah. So Bo Mine, so while they're being Mevakel Chola, and even Rabbi Baba Chana is sick, but he still has the head to learn, because learning was their entire life. So they ask him, Shnaim Shevi you get, Medina Siyam Chola, this din about where two people bring a get from Medina Siyam, do they have to be able to say B'fanei Nechta, B'fanei Nechta? And as they were having the discussion, Adahochi, so as they were discussing it, a certain chavra came, and I'll explain in a second what a chavra is. Shakla l'shraga mikamaygu. He took away the lamp from in front of them. The chavra, chavri in plural, were Persians. So now they were in Bavel. Rabbi Vachana was from Eretz Yisrael, but he visited Bavel very often. So he was visiting Bavel. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbo, or the Rabbanon, are chachamim from Bavel. So this was in Bavel, which at that time was ruled over by the Persians. The Persian religion at that time, it's called Zoroastrianism, one of their big beliefs was they worshipped fire. They had a concept of two gods, and one of them, their god of good, they believed has to do with fire. So especially on their chagas, on their religious holidays, the law was they wouldn't allow fires to be lit any place outside of their temples. We added something a little bit about it, actually, at the end of Nedarim. There was a discussion over there about, for example, is a Yid allowed to sell them wood, which they're going to end up using in their temple, not necessarily for the actual worship, but just to heat up the place so people can go and pray over there. But yeah, we find in various places in Gemara that they made a big deal about fire, especially on their chagas. So now this Persian galach came in and took the lamp. So that's because it was illegal to have it at that time. Omar, so Rabbi Baba Chana says, Rachmana, Eibishte. Either we should be in your shadow, meaning you take us out of Golos and put us under your direct protection, or put us under the protection of Bnei Esav, of the Romans, because at this point the Romans are having more derech eretz for us than the Persians are. So the Gemara asks, remember the Remoi Malum and Parsoi, so you're telling me the Romans are better than the Persians? V'altoni Rabchia, didn't Reb Chiya teach a Braisa? My dichtiv, what does it mean, a pasuk, Elokim Haven Davka, Hashem understood its way, referring to the previous psukim, are talking about Chochma, which refers to Torah, the Chochma of Torah, Hashem understood its way, Vohu Yodas Mekoima, and Hashem knows its proper place. So that means Yodaya Kodesh Baruch Hu Yisrael She'en Yecholon L'Kabel Gzeiras Romiyim. Hashem knew that the Jewish people are not going to be able to take the Gzeiras of the Romans because they're too harsh. Omar the Higla is from the Babel, so therefore the Churban Bayis tradition, Hashem arranged that the Golos should be to Babel. Meaning, in other words, the Pashtus, like this, you know, Hashem could have decided that any other nation should be the superpower of that time that would destroy the first base of Mephesh and take them into Golos. But Hashem decided that Babel would be better for them than the Romans. The Roman state existed at that time, but it was little and tiny. Hashem could have made it just as strong as he made the Kassim, but instead Hashem knew that they were going to be too harsh to the Jewish people, so instead Hashem brought them into Golos and Babel. The point is, therefore, we see that the Bavliim are better than the Romans. So what is Rabbi Elchanan saying? And the answer, which, you know, eventually there was a Golos Edom after all, but Marashah points out, this Gemara is also in Pesachim, Marashah points out over here, we're talking about before the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, that then Hashem made that the Golos should be to Babel, and that way they wouldn't interfere with their learning. The Gemara mentions several other reasons in Pesachim over there, why Hashem sent them to the Golos. Davka and Babel, all of them have this in common, that this way Babel was able to become the center of Torah for the Jewish world, which it remained for well over 1,000 years after that. So why is Rabbi Bahana saying over here we'd rather be under the Romans? The answer is like Kasha, Homikami did nice to Chavri the Bubble, Holobosa the also Chavri the Bubble. It depends between before and after the Chavri came to Bubble. Now, Rashi understands the Chavri over here means the Persians. And so Rashi understands it means like this. You had at the time of Churban Bayis tradition, who was ruling over Babel, Nebuchadnezzar, and later on his son and his grandson, Evel Merodach and Belshazzar. At that time, they respected the Jews, and they allowed them to settle there peacefully and to learn Torah and didn't interfere with their religion and so forth. Then, though, what happens? Then you have the time of Babel 70 years is up, and the Persians conquered the place and took it over. Though Rashi identifies the Chavri of our Gemara as the Persians in general. Once they came along, they were much worse from when Kurdish conquered. They were much meaner to the Jews, and therefore from then on it changed. So now, other things being equal, you're better off under a different government rather than the Persians. That's the point of Rashi. Tosfos has a lot of questions on that, based on various Gemaras that imply that the Chavri are different than the Persians and that they only came much later. So Tosfos explains that the Chavri are not the Persians in general. They're a wicked nation that came and took over in Persia and in Babel later on in the times of Rabbi Yochanan, at the beginning of the time of the Gemara. And at that point, they were much worse than the Romans. Historically, what you have is like this. So you have Kodesh and Hashverosh and that whole dynasty over there of the Persians of Paras and Madai. They were eventually conquered by Alexander the Great, and then eventually they regained their independence, and they had a kingdom called the Parthians for a couple hundred years. Eventually then, yes, about in the time of Rabbi Yochanan, they were overthrown by another group called the Sasanians, and they were much more fanatical about their religion, and so it seems according to Tosfos, they're the Chavri of our Gemara, and yeah, they were being much more strict and much more fanatical about their religion, including enforcing these kinds of laws against fire in anybody's houses outside of their temple on their chagas. So that would fit better. So therefore, according to Tosfos, in other words, those Sasanians who came at that time in the 3rd century, approximately the time of the beginning of the Amudoyim, those are the Chavri that the Gemara mentions here and in some of the places, whereas up until then, the Persians had been relatively decent towards the Jewish people. Things obviously went back and forth. There were times when the Romans were better, there were times when the Persians were better, but here in this time we're talking about the Romans, relatively speaking, were better for the Jews than the Persians. During the same period, actually, the Romans were having a whole thing where they would have, they'd have an emperor for a short amount of time, and then he'd be overthrown and assassinated by the next pretender to the throne, and so on and so forth. So at that point, they weren't worrying about the Jews too much because they had their own internal politics to worry about. So that also fits in with all of this. Okay. Further on, it talks about, let's say, for example, now we know a get has to be written l'shmoi v'l'shma. It has to be written having in mind the husband and the wife who are getting divorced. So now what happens, the Gemara discusses, if you write a get shaloi l'shma, is there any way of salvaging it? So the Gemara mentions that what if you were to, for example, you would take the pen and rewrite over the letters that are already there. You already wrote B'sheni B'Shabbos, Yoim blah, L'yerach blah, whatever, the whole Nusach over there, and then you realize you didn't write it L'shma. So now you would dip the pen in the ink well, and you'd start writing over the letters that already exist, and this time you'd have in mind L'shma. So does that work? The Gemara points out that there's a machloket, that is subject to, the Gemara starts by assuming that would relate to a machloket tanoim. Namely, Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Haresha Yitzorach Lichtev as Hashem. Suppose a person is writing a Sefer Torah, Tefillin, or Mezuzah, and he has a point where he has to write Hashem's name, Yud Kei Vav Kei. Now, when a sofer is writing Hashem's name, also he has to write out the Shema. He has to write, before he writes Hashem's name, he has to say, Hareini Kosev L'Shem Kedushas Hashem. I'm writing this name having in mind the Kedusha of Hashem's name. Now, so here he's supposed to be writing Hashem's name. V'Niskaven Licht of Yehuda. But instead he made a mistake. He thought at this point he's supposed to be writing the name Yehuda, which is almost identical to Yudke Vavke, except that it has a Dalet in the middle. V'Tah V'Lehito Boy Dalet. Then by mistake he didn't write the Dalet in there. So in other words, it came out he wrote the name Yudke Vavke, but without having the Kavana, without saying L'Shem Kedushas Hashem. So does that work? So Mavrol of Kumas Makabsha Divir of Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that's fine, he can write it over again. He'll dip the pen in and rewrite over the letters that exist already, and that will make it a kosher, having in mind for the name of Hashem, and that will work. Overwrite the letters that are there now, right? Divir of Yehuda, that's what Rabbi Yehuda says. The Chachamim Omrim, Ein Hashem Min HaMuvcher. Whereas the Chacham say that's not the preferred way, that's not the right way of writing Hashem's name. Meaning, in other words, therefore they say that's possible. Now, why do they use such an odd expression? Why don't they just say possible? The Rashba brings over here from the Yerushalmi that says like this. The Chacham are saying to Rabbi Yehuda, as far as we're concerned, overwriting letters that are already there, we hold that's not even considered writing at all, which is relevant as far as Hilchos Shabbos and as far as Gittin and various other things. But even you who hold that would be considered writing, it's Einim and Amuvcher, it's not the preferred way, it's not the choice way to write Hashem's name. Meaning Hashem's name should be, Abonah over here points out at the bottom of the page, Hashem, the name which represents Hashem, which is the source of everything, should be Min HaMuvcher. It should be written in the best possible way, and it shouldn't be that it was chosen originally for something else, and now you're going to re-choose it, and you're going to reuse it for Hashem. That's not the right way to do things. So therefore, in other words, in short, the Chacham HaSayim to Rabbi Yehuda, this writing of Hashem's name is therefore possible. There's nothing you can do with it to make it kosher. You would have to cut it out and we have to cut it out or remove that whole parchment or whatever and rewrite the name of Hashem with the proper intention. So the Gemara, again, the Gemara tries to equate that this din of Gittin, and the Gemara ends up saying it's not really exactly the same thing. All right, Kol HaGet Perek Shlishi, it continues talking about Dinim of Gittin in this Perek. One thing it talks about is, first it talks about that a get has to be written L'shmoy V'l'shmoy and all that. Then it talks about a case, you could have a case where a person is bringing a get from someplace far away. Can we assume the one who gave it is still alive? Imagine, for example, the guy's old, and you bring a get from him. How do you know by the time you're delivering it, wherever it's supposed to go, that the guy is still alive? Now, you could say, what's the difference? One way or the other, his wife is free to remarry. A big nafkamina would be, what about if he died childless, and his wife is going to be a shemeres yavam, is going to require chalitza or yibum? And in that kind of case is when a man would want to give a get to his wife so that she doesn't have to go through that. So now, if we don't know whether he's alive or not, so what do we do? So the Gemara deals with various angles on that. So now, in that connection, the Mishnah brings Shloisha Dvarim Amar Rav Elazar ben Parta Lifnei Chachamim. Rav Elazar ben Parta said the following three cases in front of the Chachamim, the Kimu as Dvarav, and the Chachamim accepted that what he said is valid. The first case is Al Ir Shekifur Karkoim, a city that's under siege. So it hasn't actually been conquered yet, but it's being besieged. We don't know whether the people in there are alive or dead yet. And second of all, Val Sfinam Terefes Bayam, then you have a boat, a ship, which is being storm tossed and battered in the sea, so it's caught in a storm, but it hasn't sunk yet. The Rambam has a slightly different explanation that it means, for example, that the storm has disabled its navigation system. You know, modern times that would be it disables GPS or whatever. Back then it would be, in other words, like its rudder and its oars and whatever are gone, but it hasn't actually sunk yet. Anyway, and the third one, Vala Yotzi Lidun, and third of all, where a person is on trial for Dini Nefoshes. So in all those cases, Shein Becheskas Kayamin. In all those cases, there's a chazaka that they're still alive, the people on the boat, or the people in the city, or the person on trial, and therefore, for example, that we can deliver a get, that if they had previously given a get for their wives, and now let's say we know that they're in the city, or we know that they're on that boat, we can assume that they're alive, and therefore we can deliver that get, and it'll be effective. Habona points out over here, you see from this, you know, Chaste Hashem Kilo Somnu, you never, even at the last moment, a person's life could be saved, even though it seems that all hope is gone. On the other hand, Aval Irsha Kavshua Kaukum, on the other hand, if the city was actually conquered by the enemy forces, was finished of the Bayan, or the ship sank, Now, okay, it sank. Not necessarily did everyone on it drown, but still, you know, you don't know. Vayotze lehorig, or a person who's going out to actually be executed. He's already been convicted and is on his way to be executed. Then, noisnelein, chumre chayim, chumre mesim. Then Rabbi Elazar ben Parta explains, then we have to lechumre, consider them alive or dead. Which will mean, in the case of the get, it means we can't necessarily deliver the get because we don't know whether it's going to be effective. But also, it means bas Yisrael lekoyin, or bas koyin leYisrael, whether, for example, the man's wife is a bas Yisrael and he's a koyin, or the other way around, she's a bas koyin married to Yisrael, loy teichah b'truma, in that situation, either way she can't eat truma. If she's a bas Yisrael married to a koyin, as long as her husband is alive, she's allowed to eat truma. But if her husband passes away, then unless she has living children from him or living descendants, then she can't eat truma. So now if her husband was on this ship or in this that sank, or the city that was captured or whatever, now she has to stop eating truma because we don't know whether her husband is alive or dead. And vice versa, what about if she's a bas koyin married to Yisrael? Then it's the other way around. As long as her husband is alive, she can't eat truma. Once her husband dies, or as long as she doesn't have living descendants from him, she's allowed to go back to eating truma. But here we never know. He might be alive, therefore she still can't eat truma until she knows that he's dead. So the Chachamim accepted what he said, and that's Taka, the halacha in these cases, between whether we have reason to suspect that he's in danger, but versus where the danger is much more acute, and that affects these dinim in terms of gittin and in terms of other things. I think I've told the story before, by the way, in this shir, about the grandfather of the father of the Chacham Tzvi, the grandfather of Rabbi Yaakov Emdin, where he was on a line of people who had been captured by the Tartars during Gzeiras Tachtatah and were being executed one by one. And then when came his turn, the guy has Rachmanis on him, the goy has Rachmanis on him, and it tells him, pretend like you died and pretend like you're dead, but meanwhile I won't put the actual blade of the sword on your neck, just the flat of it, and he managed to get away. Bekitzer, everybody who was watching from windows and everything thought that he really was dead, and actually came and gave Eidos that he's dead and his wife could remarry. But she said, I don't believe it. I know in my heart my husband's still alive. Rav Yaakov Zak, his name was. Eventually, Taka, he made it out of there, and he was reunited with his wife. And everybody saw that really is, even at the last moment, the Eidos can save a person in the most unexpected way. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola. Tesayin Odebeis, talking about the Porta Adoma, which is what we're going to be learning, which we're going to be learning about this coming Shabbos. So the Rambam rather describes that when Mashiach, so we have 9 Porta Adomas have been made in Jewish history so far, and the tenth one will be prepared under the supervision of Mashiach, and that is the tenth one since the one that Moshe made. Now, so the Rebbe talks about in a Sicha that since the Gemara elsewhere mentions, the Gemara mentions in a couple of places, Moshe va'Aaron imahem, when Mashiach comes and we rebuild the third base of Mikdash, Moshe and Aaron will be there with us. That means, therefore, the details the avodah of the Parah Adumah will be accomplished by Aaron. Now, the original Parah Adumah was not done by Aaron. It was done by Elazar ben Aaron. Rashi mentions on the Pasuk in Parshas Chukas, mitzvah of the Sagan, the proper way to do it was with the Sagan, the deputy Kohen Gadol. Why? That's because a big part of the Parah Adumah is to be mechaper for the Chet Egel, and the Egel was made by Aaron, and Ein Kategor Nasas and Eger. But when Mashiach comes, and then the whole Chet Egel will be completely cleaned up, and there won't be any vestige of it, then we don't have that reason anymore. Therefore, we can say that Aaron will, in fact, certainly make that Parah. He's not going to want to give up that mitzvah. He's not going to want to delegate it to somebody else. So therefore, we can be sure that Aaron HaKohen himself will be preparing that Parah Adumah. Continuing on at the halachas of Eruv Chatzeres, So we talked about the concept of schiras rishus. We talked about that if you have a goy living on the premises with two or more Jewish families, then you need to rent the premises from him in order to be able to make an eruv chaseiros. So now, what happens if you made the schiras rishus? It's effective as long as the goy doesn't change his mind and as long as he's living there. But if he moves out and another goy moves in, then you need to do a new schiras rishus from the new one. What about if you did it for a certain amount of time? Let's say you arranged with him the schiras rishus for a year. Let's say during that time, he subletted it to somebody else. That's fine. It's a sublease. He still has rishus over it, so therefore that still works and it's enough with the first schiras. But if he dies or sells it to somebody else during that time, you'd still have to do a new schiras rishus with him. Now, here's another case also. Let's say you didn't arrange it with the goy himself, but rather with one of his servants or whatever. Then it only works as long as that person is working over there, that employee is working over there. On the other hand, that's if you just did stam. But if you did it for a certain amount of time, then you still have until the end of that time. So in other words, practically speaking, let's say you went and arranged it, let's say, with the local police precinct, and you said the siras rishus is going to be valid for a year, then it's valid even if the whole police force is replaced. But if you were to do it indefinitely, then once there are new cops over there, then you would need to arrange a new one. It seems that's how it would come out. Be that as it may, in all cases where you need a new schiros, you also need to do a new eruv, because once the schiros is out of commission, then so is the eruv, and now it's not chozer v'niyu. You can't reactivate it as an eruv. You would need to have new food, new matzah, or whatever for the eruv.